Dear listener, if you like this podcast, I want to tell you about something else you might enjoy as well. Every week, I host an online meetup. In each meeting, I give a presentation on some programming topic, or I bring a guest to the group for a discussion, or I do a code review on a member's code base, or I do some kind of consultation with one of our members. Coming to this meetup is kind of like listening to this podcast, except it's live and interactive, which means you get a chance to ask questions and participate in a conversation with other programmers like yourself. The meetup is also a fun place to meet some new friends. To learn more and to sign up, visit codewithjason.com/meetup. Now on to the episode. Hey, today I'm here with Dan Magus. Dan, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jason. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So tell us about yourself.
I'm the co-founder of a dev tool startup. We're focusing on solving a variety of problems related to builds and tests. My background's all in software engineering. I've been an engineer for about 15 years now. Before founding RWX, the startup I'm building now, I was a CTO of Root Insurance and spent about 5 years building the engineering team there. And prior to that, I was a CTO of Braintree, building payment software.
Yeah, and I definitely want to talk to you about that stuff at some point, but that'll have to be saved for a future podcast. Today, we're going to talk about testing and specifically flaky tests. I've mentioned a couple times on the show that I've recently worked on a project fixing flaky tests. And it's still something I do from time to time, squashing flaky tests as they come up. And in doing so, I've developed a lot of methods for diagnosing and fixing flaky tests. And it's something that a lot of developers have had to face. And a lot of teams maybe just like delete the flaky tests and stuff like that, which makes me a little bit sad because that's like the worst possible outcome is you just delete the test. You're basically saying, I give up. So hopefully we can share some techniques in this episode for actually fixing those so that you don't have to lose out on the benefit of the test by deleting it. But first, let me turn it over to you and ask, like, I assume you've had to deal with flaky tests in the past, and how have you felt about, well, let me ask this, how have you addressed flaky tests typically in the past?
Yeah, I think one of the things that you mentioned there around deleting tests is certainly a conversation I find myself in and in a lot of engineering teams. Most of my experience has been in startups that kind of started small and then grew to be rather large. So interestingly, as you go through that kind of experience, some problems like this, you know, you first experience in a really small scale, but then the problem tends to grow and become more problematic. That's especially true with flaky tests just due to the compounding nature of them. You know, if a test passes 9 times out of 10, you know, you only have one build out of 10 actually fail. But if you have two of those tests, you know, 20% are failing and so on. And you know, it can really get out of hand. So, you know, I think it's pretty typical for engineers on small projects and maybe just have a couple of failing tests that if they see a test fail in CI, maybe they'll look into it and try to resolve the source of flakiness, but also maybe they'll just click the retry button. I think that's usually the starting point for most engineering teams.
Yeah. Yeah. And in my perception, it's an area that not a lot of people know how to fix. It's kind of a mystery to most people. It was a mystery to me until I worked on this recent project that I worked on, and just in order to get this project done, I had to get super deep into it and figure out what causes flaky tests and how to fix them and all that. And I found in the course of doing this that the number of blog posts online that give you, or even in books, that give you sufficiently detailed instructions on how to diagnose flaky tests, the number of resources like that is exactly zero. And so, you know, you can pick up a few techniques, but like the amount of stuff out there that helps you is like woefully insufficient. If you just go by the stuff you can find online, you're not going to get there. So a lot of the stuff I just had to figure out from first principles and do it that way. And then I did put up my own blog post, which, not to sound boastful, but I think it's the best guide on the internet to fixing flaky tests. So hopefully that can be a resource for people. But yeah, I think a lot of people aren't really aware how to fix these because there's not a lot of good resources out there.
Yeah, I definitely think that a lot of them could be challenging to fix. I mean, I really like the point that you made in your blog post around, you know, the source is non-determinism. And, you know, there's something that is varying in how that test is executed that obviously is resulting in this scenario where sometimes the test passes and sometimes it fails.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, and somewhat challengingly, though, there can be like varying degrees of non-determinism, you know, such that some of those sources are perhaps easy to find and resolve. You know, as one example, the last company I worked for, we used Faker to generate kind of fake data. Mm-hmm. I think it's a common Ruby library that a lot of Ruby projects use. And we had some automated tests that would sometimes assert on the contents of an HTML page because we wanted to make sure that the HTML output included certain strings. Well, I remember this one a lot because it happened a lot. Occasionally, Faker would generate a last name that had an apostrophe in it. Well, every time it did it, the apostrophe would get escaped in the HTML. So when we were asserting on the contents, it wouldn't match because we were expecting, we just took the Ruby string and said, you know, expect HTML to include. We passed in the string that we expected to see, but it wasn't there because the apostrophe character got turned into an ampersand APOS semicolon and the test would fail. Interestingly, you know, sometimes putting randomness in your tests could be helpful. That's actually an entire you know, testing strategy is kind of this fuzz testing of generating, you know, various random inputs and making sure that your tests still pass. So sometimes when you're using random inputs and a test fails, you actually discover a bug. Other times you just make your test non-deterministic and you have a flaky test.
Yeah.
And I remember for that particular one, you know, occasionally we'd go and we'd replace the random values that were generated with static values, which is a good way to make the test deterministic. Although we also had some assertion helpers that if we were going to assert on HTML contents, of course, it made sense that we had to escape those values.
I see. Yeah, that's a good example of that apostrophe example is a good example of how randomness can give rise to non-determinism. And I actually want to real quick list all the causes of non-deterministic, all the causes of non-determinism that cause flaky tests. Because as far as I'm aware, there are exactly 5 root causes, and every cause of a flaky test you can come up with falls into one of these 5 categories. And there's a chance I'm wrong, but nobody has told me I'm wrong yet. Nobody has come up with an example yet that doesn't fit into one of these 5. And I'm curious, Dan, if you can think of one that doesn't fit into these 5. But here they are real quick. So race conditions is a big one. And that's... I wrote a definition, so I'm just going to read off my definition here. It's when the correct functioning of a program depends on 2 or more parallel actions completing in a certain sequence, but the actions sometimes complete in a different sequence, resulting in incorrect behavior. And it doesn't matter what form the race condition takes. Sometimes it can be one element on the page that you're expecting to be there, and then your test executes at a certain speed, but the page loads at a certain speed, and so there's a race condition there. It can take all kinds of different forms, but that's the idea behind that. Number 2 is what I call leaked state. So here's an example that I've dealt with. When you have Sidekick involved in an application, by default in the test suite, Sidekick will be turned off and none of your background jobs will run. But sometimes in your tests, the stuff that happens in the background job matters, so you want to turn Sidekick on. Well, if you turn Sidekick on in one test, but forget to turn it off at the end of the test, that state will leak into the subsequent tests. And different tests might have different susceptibility to being affected by that. And so let's say, for example, you have one test in your test suite that turns Sidekick on but not off again. And then you have another test in your test suite that gets messed up by that. And so it fails when that other test comes before it. And because the tests are run in a random order, sometimes your leaky test will run first and then your susceptible test will run after and there will be a problem. Sometimes it'll run the other way around and there will be no problem and it'll appear really mysterious what's happening because the test that's failing is not actually the test that has a problem. The problem is in a different test and there's no indication of the problem with that test. It comes out in the other one.
Yeah, it's definitely something I've seen before. And it's actually a good example of what we were just talking about with sometimes randomness can help you find bugs. You know, interestingly, on one hand, you could say, well, I'm always just going to run my tests in the exact same order because that's more deterministic and then I won't have flaky tests. On the other hand, if you actually want to know if you have any of this leaky state in your tests, it's actually helpful to shuffle up the order and make sure the tests still pass. I think probably one technique that is underutilized is maybe trying to isolate those two objectives. And, you know, for your core builds, make sure you do always run your tests in the exact same order. You know, maybe hard code the randomness seed if your testing framework supports that, or alphabetically sort the test files or something like that. But then, you know, perhaps have a build that's run, you know, once a day or periodically, or, you know, however you decide to do it, that will shuffle that order and make sure the tests still pass. So that way you're both making sure that you're checking for any leaky state that could be lurking there, as you described, but only showing up when the tests are running in a certain order. But at the same time, you know, you're not testing that on your core build that's running on each commit and is interfering with your engineer's productivity and feedback loop.
Yeah, my fear with running the tests normally in a fixed order would be that it would be too easy to develop these tests that have leak state, and then I have a bug with no symptom. You know, it's a time bomb. It's only going to come out when I run the tests in random order. So I think I would be inclined to run my tests in random order normally. But then when I'm trying to diagnose a problem, it could be helpful to run them in the same order multiple times.
Yeah, no, that definitely makes sense. And you know, the leaky state actually can work in both directions. The example we were just talking about is a case where you know, a test is doing something that then, you know, maybe leaks some state and breaks the test that runs after it. Interestingly, tests can also leak state that make the test that runs after them pass, such that if that test is run in isolation, that second test, it actually won't pass because it was actually depending on the leak state from the previous test.
I can very easily imagine how that could be the case. Yeah.
Yeah, we just ran into this. One of the tools that we built at RWX is called ABQ. And ABQ is a parallel test runner. So it's designed to take test suites and run them in parallel jobs on CI services. Well, the RSpec bindings for ABQ put every individual test inside the queue as opposed to like entire files. And most test parallelization libraries are based on files, but ABQ will go down to the granularity of individual tests. We just had a customer go live with ABQ yesterday that when they first integrated it, they actually had some failures in their test suite. And it's because ABQ was, in some cases, dispatching these two tests to different worker nodes that previously they had always run together. And when they were separated like that, the test failed. So the engineers that we were working with on this, you know, looked into it and kind of realized what was happening and kind of felt like ABQ helped them find a bug in their tests.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, that's not a case that I had considered, but that makes total sense. Another cause of non-determinism can be network dependency and third-party service dependency. And one of the reasons why network dependency can cause non-determinism is pretty obvious. Sometimes the network works and sometimes it doesn't. Similar thing with third-party services. A third-party service goes down from time to time. And then another interesting thing I've seen, I don't know how often this happens, but I have seen it, is hitting a third-party service in a test suite and getting rate limited. And so obviously once you get rate limited and they throttle you, then your test is going to start failing because there's no result being returned anymore. And obviously the fix to that, I mean, maybe not obviously, but the fix to that is to don't do that. Don't hit the network. Don't hit third-party services. Stub that stuff out.
Yeah, definitely. Teams I've worked on typically have used libraries like VCR to mock out web requests and effectively make them deterministic. You know, make them deterministic by making sure that the same requests return the same responses, so that, you know, all you're really testing is the code that you've written and not the third-party service. And VCR works really well. In fact, I think there's even libraries, at least in Ruby, like WebMock, where you can then configure your project to raise an exception if there's any network request that isn't mocked out, which is super helpful for making sure that you have VCR present in all places. I will say that I've worked previously on some engineering teams where we felt like we didn't want to use VCR because, you know, maybe we didn't totally trust the third party not to change their interface. And we kind of looked at it and said, well, shoot, like if this test fails because this third party changed something about their API, we want to know that because that can have an upstream impact on our service. But I think similar to what we were talking about with, like race conditions and other issues of non-determinism in test suites, I think the real solution to that is to separate your testing from your monitoring. And I think in most of your builds, you're going to want to mock out. Mock out those network requests so that your tests are deterministic. But then hopefully you can set up some other type of monitoring process that will maybe either periodically actually hit those APIs to make sure they're performing as expected. Or I've also worked on engineering teams that have set up separate builds on the side that would periodically do things like re-record the VCR cassettes. So maybe, you know, once a day or even once a week or something, you know, just rerun that, record those VCR cassettes and make sure they're still coming out the same. I guess if you're wanting to do this for monitoring purposes, you're going to want to run it more frequently than that. But I think, again, the solution here is just separating those out into two distinct builds that you're running.
I couldn't agree more. I've never done that separate monitoring thing, but as you were talking, I'm like, yeah, what if you had a thing that like didn't run every time your test suite was invoked, but it only did it like once a day? And I guess the thing I was thinking of was monitoring. So that makes total sense. The next thing on my list of five, this is number four, is randomness. And that's a pretty easy one to explain too. The example I use with this is like, if you have a random number between 1 and 5, and then you assert that it's 3, obviously it's going to fail 4/5 of the time. So anything that depends on randomness is susceptible to non-determinism. Yeah, that's one where maybe they can be tricky to diagnose because it might not be clear what's happening. Like I've had that exact same issue with Faker, where the specific name that was being generated interfered with the test in some way. Like there was some specific word that we were asserting was not present on the page, but sometimes somebody's name would contain that word. And so the test would fail sometimes. Those ones can be kind of tricky to notice.
I've definitely hit those. And, interestingly, sometimes it's hard because, you know, I think you look at this and you say like, well, why don't you just always use static values everywhere? You know, but then sometimes you have things like a database unique constraint, or something like that, where, you know, you feel inclined to use random values so that, you're getting a wider variety of test data. You know, you are generating unique values. In some cases you can try to use static values, but if you're using like a lot of helper functions or factories to set up your data, you know, it's pretty hard to hard code every single value that's going to be used there and not be using some sort of functions to generate it. So it can be surprisingly difficult, I think, to, you know, completely avoid randomness inside test data. But you definitely, as you point out, you know, have to watch out for tests that are maybe going to be affected by that.
Yeah. And that's another scenario. If you have a unique constraint and your randomness is susceptible to generating the same value twice, and then you can, you know, if you create a user named John Smith and then you create 100 more users and then your 101st user also happens to be named John Smith, you're going to get a collision.
Yep, definitely.
So my last item on my list is fixed time dependency. And this one is maybe a little bit trickier to explain and understand. And here's the example I like to use with this one. Let's say you have a report that shows, for example, all the appointments for today. And it creates an appointment that occurs 4 hours from whatever time it is right now. So if it's 8 a.m. and you create an appointment that's 4 hours from now, that appointment would occur at 12 o'clock p.m. It's the same day, so that appointment shows up on the report. And so when you assert that that appointment is present, the test passes. But then let's say you run the test at 10 p.m. If you create that appointment again 4 hours from right now, the appointment will occur at 2 a.m. the next day. And so then when I assert that that appointment is present on the report, my test will fail. And I actually had a situation like this. I was working late one day and I ran the tests and a bunch of tests started failing really mysteriously. And it just turns out I'd never worked that late before. And there were tests that would always pass that late, or sorry, there would always fail that late due to a fixed time dependency. So what I did was I set up a thing that would like automatically run the tests at fixed times throughout the day to try to prevent against those cases. But that's the other cause of non-determinism that I've identified.
Yeah, that's definitely another really common one. Obviously, time zones are just notoriously difficult for engineers to work with in some cases. And this is another one where I feel like, you know, sometimes you can look at it and feel like the solution is pretty simple. It's like, okay, well, if you know, running your tests at dynamic times, you know, is causing problems, just don't do that. You know, use something like TimeCop or, you know, just hard code the time. But I found that's difficult in a couple ways, mostly actually pertaining to additional third-party libraries. You know, sometimes when you're doing time-based logic, you know, you want to make sure, like in the appointment example, it's pretty easy to imagine a piece of functionality where you want to know, like, is this appointment in the past or in the future? So obviously that's dependent not only on how your data is set up, but on like what time you're calling the method. Well, you know, it's pretty easy to just add a parameter to that method to pass in the current time, default that parameter to time.now, but then in your tests, you can kind of pass in whatever time you want. And that actually is like, I think, a very good solution to this problem. But sometimes as you go down through your software stack, it just gets a little bit harder to handle that, especially if you cross a boundary into a third-party library. Because then you need all the functions that you're calling to also be able to pass in the current time. And you know, if you're crossing into like a database library, you know, maybe it's using the database's built-in now function for the current time and doesn't let you pass in and say, execute this as if this is the current time. I've also worked with some third-party APIs that have, you know, time-based validations in them. Like I think I've hit this one in S3 before where I was trying to generate like a pre-signed URL. That pre-signed URL is supposed to have an expiration time. Well, that library had a built-in check to make sure that the expiration time wasn't in the past because it wanted to make sure that you weren't generating a link that was already expired. So, you know, I got my test to work. I hard-coded my time values. It was great. The test was passing. I thought it wasn't going to be flaky or, you know, based on any sort of randomness or non-determinism. And then the next day, it started failing and started failing permanently. Because now all of a sudden that like pre-signed URL I was trying to generate had an expiration date that was in the past and, you know, that wasn't okay anymore. So I think that's like, you know, definitely a challenging scenario and it's tough to know that's going to happen because I haven't seen great techniques for like running builds at different times. I've considered going all the way to the extent of like trying to modify the system clock on a server to be able to do that, but it's usually kind of a futile effort. And you know, the example I just shared is kind of interesting too. And the example you're talking about with time-based tests, because, you know, we were talking so far on this podcast about like flakiness and kind of this intermittent like passing and failing of tests. But there's also kind of the sudden failures where, you know, your test is passing and now all of a sudden, you know, it's just broken. And that can be pretty disruptive to an engineering team too. When all of a sudden everybody's builds are just permanently broken because the test that had been passing is now just failing.
Yeah, that's rough. It's like akin to an outage. It really affects everybody.
Yeah. And it's especially bad if it happens and, you know, then there's an actual technical problem to deal with, you know, if that, right. If something like that coincides with, a production problem that you want to try to get a fix out for, you know, now you're kind of in trouble because nobody can get a passing build. And, you know, hopefully your engineering team has kind of break glass procedures for that or something they can do, but it can be pretty difficult to handle.
Yeah, it's never good. Okay, so I wanted to go over those causes of flaky tests. Oh, and by the way, Dan, I'm curious, can you think of any kinds of flakiness or non-determinism or whatever that doesn't fall into one of those categories?
I think those are pretty good categories from actual issues that I've seen in practice, but you know, there probably are some other system issues, you know, even things like running out of disk space. Like I've had that one happen. Maybe that's not pertaining to like a test individually, but builds as a whole. Also, if you consider builds as a whole and not tests individually, you know, just things like different versions of software libraries, how your CI systems set up dependencies. You know, I think now we're pretty good at having tools that will have pinning, have lock files so that you're only ever upgrading third-party dependencies, you know, when you intentionally make a change to upgrade them. But, you know, before those tools were as mature as they are now, you know, in that regard, you know, sometimes you would just have like a system dependency that all of a sudden was different than you expected, or you'd have something on your CI machine that's different than your local machine. And that could kind of cause flakiness or test failures that are unexpected too.
Yeah, maybe my third-party network dependency category should be more general to just external dependency, because the hard disk thing seems to me like an external dependency. And then, you know, the state of that. Wait. No. It falls under an existing category. One falls under leaked state because, it could. Because, like, if your tests, for example, like each test fills up the disk a little bit more, it's leaking state. It's leaking state into the hard disk. And then eventually that causes a problem.
Yeah, I think that's fair. You know, partly, I love your broad categorization of just non-determinism, but I think there's also one of side effects. So, you know, people that are really enthusiastic about functional programming, you know, would be really aware of this too, where, you know, you kind of have your pure functions, just inputs, outputs, function calls, you know, no third-party services or side effects at all. But then you do have side effects. And, there's a programming language that I'm really interested in called Brock. And they're doing a lot of work to have engineers always kind of declare side effects in functions. And that does include things like time. Like if you want to, you know, make a system call to get the current time, you know, it's kind of side effect based. Same thing, randomness, like even just generating like a random number is that way. Disk access, network access, you know, these are all things that in some programming languages, you drop that into your function and you don't really think anything of it. But anytime you do that, you're introducing a failure scenario that is not going to be present in just a pure function. So I think just kind of categorically, it's something to be mindful of.
I don't understand. So what I am aware of regarding side effects in functions is, or at least my take on it is, side effects in functions have a cost in that it's harder to understand a function that has a side effect than a function that doesn't. And so that's my view on why it's better to try to avoid side effects, because otherwise you pay that cost. I'm having trouble understanding the connection to flaky tests.
I think it's not going to be flaky in terms of you know, like non-deterministic application behavior, you know, but for example, it could be easy to write a function that reads a file off disk and then, you know, the state of that file is different than you expected. So it's a similar case to what you described with leaked state in general. You know, I think probably as application developers, we tend to think of that as database state and state in the database, you know, but a file system, you know, is a similar like external resource that, you know, is something outside of the inputs to a function that affect that function's behavior, which can then lead, you know, towards this issue. Like back to the example of disk issues, even file system permissions, you know, it's typically not going to be flaky in terms of passing and failing sometimes, but you know, you could be reliant on certain things outside of your source code that affect how your source code runs. So I think you're probably right that this is kind of a bit different than just pure flakiness, but it is a source of you know, your code executing differently than you think it might execute based on the environment or other issues.
I think, unless I'm mistaken, and tell me if I'm not understanding right, that would still be a case of flaky tests. And I think my five categories still stand intact.
Yeah.
Because I actually did use that example in one of my writings of changing a file in the file system in one test, and then a later test is expecting that file to be in a certain state, but it's been modified, and so there's non-determinism, and it's a problem. So either that is still a case of non-determinism causing a flaky test, or there's something I don't understand.
Yeah, no, I think you've got a pretty solid list here. You know, okay. I think the sources of these things are, you know, random values, time, external state, like disk access, network sockets, and then, you know, as you mentioned too, like race conditions.
Yeah. Yeah, and so I would encourage anyone who wants to strengthen their ability to fix flaky tests, get familiar with these five categories of non-determinism, because this is like the ABCs of fixing flaky tests. Like if you're familiar with these and you have like, if you have these like stored in your own memory in your brain, then you can recognize these cases when you see them, and it just makes everything that much easier. So let me just refresh my memory for a second. Yeah, so I have this kind of process that I run through, and this is something that I had never like written down or anything until I tried to write this blog post. And it's not exactly a linear process. It's kind of a bag of tricks, although some parts of it are linear. So the first thing I do, and I mention this because I've made mistakes before because of not doing this, the first thing I do when trying to fix a flaky test is make sure it's actually a flaky test. I don't know if that's happened to you before, Dan, where you go to fix a flaky test and you're like expending time and energy to fix this flaky test, and then you discover later that it was actually a legitimate failure.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's easy to have happen. Like, well, it could be a legitimate failure due to like a bug in your application code. Mm-hmm. You know, hopefully if you go to fix it, you know, you run it more than once, I guess, and try to see if it's just consistently failing or passing. But, you know, I think we kind of think of a lot of these causes as a problem with the test itself or how the test is written. But certainly some of this could be caused by, you know, I think your five categories applied to application logic. You know, that could mean that there actually is a piece of application functionality that's broken, which is why you've got to be really mindful of, you know, I think something you said at the beginning of the podcast here around like, do you just delete the flaky tests? Sometimes you do want to be pretty cautious about that because, you know, that failure, it might even be flaky and intermittent, but it could be intermittent due to an issue in the application code, not an issue in the test data setup.
Exactly. That's something that took me a while to realize, is that the non-determinism could be present either in the test code or in the application code. It doesn't matter where it is. If there's non-determinism present, it can lead to a flaky test.
Absolutely. And if it's in the application code, you know, it also means your application code is non-deterministic, which means, you know, you might have a piece of functionality in your application that sometimes works and sometimes doesn't.
Right. Yeah. So something I've talked about on the show before is dividing a bug fix endeavor into three distinct steps of reproduction, diagnosis, and fix. And I found that it pays to do those three as separate steps. A lot of developers get really muddy about that, and they're working on a bug fix, and they're not clear in their own minds about like, what am I doing right now? Am I trying to diagnose this bug? Am I trying to fix it? So they'll look at something, they'll maybe like jump to a conclusion and start fixing it. And like, it just, it can create so much waste because you're not really sure what you're actually doing, and you're it's easy to make mistakes and like apply a fix that's not really fixing a real problem, and you deploy it. Turns out the bug is still there because your fix wasn't the right thing. You have to go back and do it all over again. I've seen that kind of waste a bunch of times. That's why I think it's good to split it into those three steps.
Yeah, I think that's a really great recommendation. I mean, certainly when you can, I think that's the ideal process to follow. You know, I think in some cases it can be extremely difficult to reproduce a failure. And mm-hmm. in those scenarios, you know, I think I usually want to fault an engineer for forming a hypothesis, trying to fix, and then seeing if it helps. But I'd say, you know, only in the case where just that reproduction is extremely difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. So, of course, the reason I mentioned this bug fix process is because I consider a flaky test to be a kind of bug. And so I follow this three-step process just like I would with any other bug. And you're exactly right that reproduction step can be very, very difficult, sometimes basically impossible. So something you can do sometimes is if the flaky test fails sufficiently frequently, you can just run the test suite like 10 times or 50 times or something like that and observe the failures. And if you run the test suite, let's say 50 times, and you get a handful of failures, then you've reproduced it. But sometimes a flaky test fails really seldomly, like maybe it happens once a month or something like that. And so in those cases, I usually don't ordain flaky status to a test the very first time I've seen it flake. I usually wait until, if I can't reproduce it on demand, I'll observe that it failed and say, okay, this is a candidate for a flaky test, but I'm not going to try to fix it yet. And then maybe like a month later or something, I see it fail again. And I say, okay, this gives me stronger credence that this really is a flaky test. Now I feel justified in spending the time trying to fix it.
Yeah, I think it's definitely worthwhile to prioritize like that. One of the tools that we built at RWX is called Captain. Captain is a CLI that provides a variety of functionality actually related to flaky tests in terms of automatically retrying test failures to determine whether or not they're flaky, which I think is like what you're talking about here. Like go ahead and run the failures again to look for flakiness. And because we have those retries, we can also do flaky test detection and quarantining.
Oh, nice.
So one of the things that, yeah, that most of our customers, Captain is an open source CLI that you can use on any project totally for free, but we also have a cloud component. And one thing that most of our customers will do with the cloud component is just be gathering these statistics on flakiness over time so that they can always look in and see like, is this the first time I've seen this? Have other engineers on the team seen it? Because usually engineers are only looking at their own builds and it's hard to get a comprehensive overview. And then we find most teams will prioritize effort they're putting into addressing flaky tests by just, you know, the ones that they're seeing the most occurrences around.
Yeah, I really like the idea of keeping track of those flaky tests in an automated way. That sure beats like having an Excel sheet somewhere that you keep track of your flaky tests or something like that.
Yeah, definitely. I've had teams do it, you know, with spreadsheets, with issue trackers. We designed Captain to make it really easy, but obviously, you know, having those sort of analytics is really helpful for prioritization overall.
Yeah. So we're talking about reproduction. The next step after reproduction is diagnosis. So let's say we've reproduced it enough to be confident that it's actually a flaky test. How do we diagnose it? The first thing I recommend is to have a completely open mind. This applies to any bug fixing endeavor, obviously, but a lot of people jump to conclusions or they at least bias themselves in a certain direction and say, oh, it's probably this, so I'm going to follow this certain path and go looking for this root cause because they developed a hunch for some reason. And sometimes that's like smart and justified, and that can make things more efficient, but not always. So I prefer to always err on the side of being totally open-minded and saying, okay, I admit that I know nothing right now, and all I'm going to do is make observations and collect information.
Yeah, I think that's a great approach, Jason. And I think it's pretty similar to just good advice for diagnosing production issues too. It's a really similar process. In some cases, production issues can be also difficult to reproduce. And then, you're kind of on this diagnosis step, and sometimes it's easy to look at it and feel like it's similar to an error that you've seen before and you just know what the fix is. But usually you want to form some sort of hypothesis and then actually validate it, or like you're saying, figure out a way to diagnose it and, make sure that you're not just jumping to a conclusion, based on similarities to other issues when actually it could be a different problem.
Yeah. And something I teach sometimes is Bayesian logic. So like, rather than saying, oh, this is it, I knew somebody once who, like, whenever we were troubleshooting, they would be like, oh, it's this. Yep, it's definitely this. And then it would turn out to be not that. And then we'd cycle through other ideas and they'd be like, oh, it's this. It's definitely that. And it's like, no, that's like, you're hurting yourself by being that certain. It's better to form an idea and be like, okay, well, maybe it's that. I'll say there's like a 20% chance it's this, or a 10% chance it's this. I'll like hold that in my mind as a possibility rather than jumping to that conclusion. And, maybe you even have some notes where you collect hypotheses along with like the strength of how much you like believe that that may be the case. That leads to like more efficient diagnosis, I think, than obviously jumping into conclusions. It's too easy to hurt yourself.
Yeah, I really like that suggestion for, keeping an open mind and a long list and then just kind of weighting those hypotheses by how likely you think it is, but trying to be mindful of all of them. And much like solving production issues, sometimes it's important to have this too, because if you are struggling to reproduce, your choice sometimes is really only to try to instrument or change the code in a way that makes it easier to diagnose. So much like a production bug that might be hard to track down, if you're really struggling, sometimes you end up shipping an update to production that maybe includes additional logging lines, about like what's happening, or tries to give you more insight somehow. And I think it's similar here. If there's a failure that's only showing up on CI and you really can't reproduce it, and maybe you have some ideas, then ultimately what it usually comes down to is trying to figure out, okay, like what can I add to the code that will maybe put more clarity around this exception, or let me rescue this exception here and add something about the state that the application is in when this occurs. So that then once you do see the failure again, hopefully you have a little bit more information to go through that cycle, start at the top again, try to reproduce, and then diagnose.
Yeah, that's a great tip. And that's something that I've done too in the diagnosis step, because sometimes you see a failure message and it's not very informative. And you can look at it and think, okay, well, if I had this extra contextual information, then I'd have a better shot at diagnosing this. And so it's kind of time. Well, it's like time consuming on the calendar. Maybe it doesn't take a lot of, maybe it only takes you a few minutes to put that in there, but then you'll have to wait a few days or something for that to occur again. But that's definitely a good technique for getting closer to the root cause. Something I wanted to mention was, you said something about failing on CI versus locally and stuff like that. I want to be very clear. This entire conversation, I've been operating under the premise that all this is on CI. I've heard developers say like, oh, I had this flaky test, but I couldn't reproduce it locally. So I guess that's that. So I'm not talking about like reproducing any of this stuff locally. I'm making the assumption that you can't reproduce any of this stuff locally. This is all on CI. And there are specific reasons why tests fail more frequently on CI than locally. And I have a whole list of, again, I think it's the exhaustive list of the reasons why tests fail on CI more than locally. We don't necessarily need to get into all that. Don't like have hopes that you're going to be able to reproduce flaky tests locally. Almost by definition, they won't.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Although it depends on the cause. I think, which of those five causes that you mentioned, is the actual cause of flakiness. If it is something like randomness, I think that's one that's a little bit easier to see. On a local execution. If it's something like race conditions, especially, you're running different hardware on CI than you have locally and things like that, I think it can be a bit harder. So depending on the cause, definitely maybe able to reproduce locally, but maybe not. But I agree, the harder ones are the ones that are showing up in CI where you actually can't reproduce locally.
Yeah.
We actually had one group of engineers that's using Captain suggested to us that we actually add something that if you think you fix a flaky test, Captain has the ability to, as I shared, to retry tests when they fail to make sure that the failure is actually legitimate and not due to flakiness. They requested that we have Captain add the ability to retry tests that pass. So if they're pushing a commit and they think they fixed the cause of flakiness, they wanted to know if they could, have Captain say, even though this test passed, like run it 10 times to make sure that this fix actually did resolve the issue. We actually haven't added that one to Captain yet, but I thought it was kind of a clever idea. And I could see where it's necessary because like you're describing the difficulty in all of this, you might even think you fixed it, but if it's actually failing, only 1 out of 10 times, you kind of have to wait even after you've, pushed your commit and merged it in to, see if it's going to pop up again or not.
Yeah. I wonder which categories of flaky tests that kind of thing would be possible for, because I can imagine like a test that fails, that flakes because of randomness. Definitely. A test that flakes due to, for example, fixed time dependency, that would be a little harder because you'd have to run it at various times of day. You'd have to like wait 24 hours to get the results back. Leaked state, that would be very tough because, out of all the orders in which the tests could possibly run, like how can you be confident that you've hit that specific order that causes that test to flake, and then third party or external dependency or whatever, that one might be really tough because if there's a test that flakes due to like hitting some external service or something like that, how could you ever reproduce those conditions that would have led to the flakiness, but don't now because it's fixed? So that does seem like a good idea, but it maybe would have to come with an asterisk that it can only give you certainty for certain categories.
Yeah, I don't think that's a really important point.
Okay, so here's kind of the rest of the process that I go through. So when I identify a flaky test, and again, I'm confident that it's really a flaky test, I look at the failure messages. I don't always expect to see anything super helpful, but I at least look because you got to start somewhere. And then I'll look at the test code. And at this point, I'm just kind of making observations. I'm not yet trying to make a diagnosis. I'm just looking at the test and asking like, is this a big test or is it small? Is it easy to understand or is it not? And of course, I'll keep my eye out the whole time for one of these root causes of non-determinism. Because if I see something that's obvious, then I'll say, okay, this is a strong candidate for what could be the root cause. And so maybe I'll dig deeper into that. But at this stage, I'm just trying to get the lay of the land and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's definitely a great process to follow.
And sometimes, sometimes just looking at the test, maybe this particular test suite I've been looking at follows a pattern. And so I say, oh, they did this again. That's obvious. I'll fix that. So I might stumble upon it that way. But if I don't, then my next step is I'll look at the application code. Because as we said before, the non-determinism might be in the test code or the application code. So that's where I'll look next. Assuming I still don't know the cause, which I usually don't at this stage, I'll go back to the test and I will try to make the test as easy to understand as possible, with the reason being simply that it's easy to understand things than to troubleshoot hard to understand things. And so without thinking about anything to do with flaky tests at this point, I'll just take the test and restructure it, because it's rare that I come across a test and I can't think of any way it could be improved. Usually I open a test and I think, oh no, what does this test even do? It's so unclear. And so I'll move it around a little bit to try to make it clearer. And the funny thing is, sometimes I don't even need to do anything more and the flakiness is just gone. So I never even need to find out what the cause was or do anything to fix it. I just somehow fix it by restructuring it. And that's fine. Who cares what the cause was as long as I fix it. But that's the next step.
Yeah, I think that's a really great step in the process too. And one thing I'd add, you know, throughout this is I think it's always great for engineers to take time to understand the problem and try to think about solutions. But you know, if you're fortunate enough to be working on a team, you know, with great coworkers, you know, I think definitely take that failure and take some of those ideas and, you know, briefly just check with the team and, you know, see, has anybody seen this before? Or, you know, does this look like something that you've diagnosed? How have you diagnosed this successfully? You know, because I think, you know, the methodology you're proposing is fantastic for just kind of like just general advice, great software engineering practices for, you know, people to get really good at applying. But, you know, a lot of the challenges that we deal with on projects can be somewhat project specific, you know, the exact set of the language, the framework, the libraries that you're using, you know, other things that are maybe unique to that project as a whole. I think it's also good to just, you know, kind of circulate that failure and see if anybody else on the team can lend any expertise to solving it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I've definitely relied on my coworkers a lot. When there's a test I don't understand, I'll look at GitBlame and I'll see like, okay, who has touched this? Maybe they can give me some insight as to what this is all about. It definitely helps.
Yeah.
Okay, so after I've gone and made the test code as easy to understand as I can, again, sometimes that just fixes it, and that's great. If it doesn't fix,
Let me pause real quick, uh-huh. Jason. Like, how do you think about? You know, I definitely agree with what you're saying. Of you know, try to make it easier to understand. You know, you also do run the risk a little bit that, you know, maybe you change something in a way where you know you did it for understanding, but you actually changed some behavior, or maybe you even fixed it and didn't realize it. How do you think about making those changes, but you know, doing so if you haven't fully understood exactly why a test is flaky?
That's a great question. That's a danger that I'm definitely very conscious of when I'm doing these. One part of that is to go just a little bit at a time. And don't let my changes run ahead of my level of understanding. And so I will often... Okay, so there's this technique I learned from Michael Feathers' book. He has extract method and extract class, where like if you're working with some legacy code, you want to refactor it, but there's no tests and you're afraid to, you can, for example, take a chunk of 100 lines and move it to a different method or something like that. That's a very minimal change. And so the risk is low of introducing a regression. And so I kind of do that sort of thing. The first thing I do is like, maybe there's just like, things like spacing and formatting and stuff like that, very low risk changes. But if I just take like, you know, if there's 40 lines that are all smushed together and I just add some logical spacing so they're grouped, that can do a lot to advance understanding. And then a lot of times just like the names of things are inappropriate. And so I'll change the names to something clearer. It's again, a very low risk change. The labels on the tests, a lot of times the labels on the test don't actually match what's being done. And so once I think I've gained an understanding for what the test is doing, I update the label to be a little more truthful. And again, that's a very low risk change because I'm not actually changing any code. So I'll start with like the really easy, really low risk stuff like that. And maybe I'll do a commit and merge that's just that, because I don't want to mix in the high-risk changes with the low-risk changes. So I'll get the low-risk changes on the books first, and then I'll start fresh with maybe some of the higher-risk changes. And I say higher risk, but I don't even really mean like high risk in absolute terms, because I don't want to make any high-risk changes to the test. Because like you said, I don't want to change the test in a way that actually makes it test something different. So another thing I'll do, there's the four phases of a test. There's setup, exercise, assertion, and teardown. And often with flaky tests, there's not a clear distinction among those four things. And so I'll take a chunk of setup code that's right in there in the test case where the assertion and exercise should be by themselves. And I'll just take that chunk of setup code and I'll move that to a setup block. So stuff like that, like I'm usually not trying to make really drastic changes. And actually, by the time I've made all these low-risk changes, I've spent so much time with the test at that point that I understand it very well. And then I can make those more fundamental changes with high confidence.
Yeah, I love how methodical that process is. I think a lot of engineers could learn a lot from the steps that you just walked through about how you approach solving some things like this. One thing I'd maybe add onto that is that I feel like sometimes after you go through that, maybe you actually do get some additional clarity on the problem, and then you can figure out what the fix needs to be. One thing that I've seen some great engineers do is when they have that, take that fix and actually go back to the code before they moved anything around and see if they can apply that fix to like the original state.
Yes.
Of the code. Because then they get a lot of, confirmation that, okay, this was the fix. It works on the old version, but then go ahead and make things better. Leave the code better than you found it, make those improvements too, but really just try to isolate that fix on the original code.
Yeah. I did that just this week. Actually, there was this big, long test. I tried to split it up into multiple files and I was having trouble with it. It felt like too big of a change and things kind of fell apart on me anyway. And so I thought, okay, maybe this is too high risk. I don't want to pull the trigger on this. But in the course of doing all that, I did find the root cause. And so I went back and I made the minimal change. Because it's not only about fixing the bug, it's about fixing the bug in the least risky way possible. And that's definitely my preference too. Like, it's good to clean up the test, but if you can, and it's about atomicity too, like you don't want to mix in all this refactoring and the bug fix. It's better to release just that very minimal bug fix. If you can do it in just one line and not touch anything else, so much the better. And then on the heels of that, you can come in and do your refactoring as a separate step. That way, if your refactoring turns out to introduce a problem, you can revert the refactoring without having to revert the bug fix.
Yeah, that's a really great point.
So I do that. And then if still I haven't found the issue, and I want to make the comment that even without actively looking for the problem, sometimes just this process of just working with this test more and more, it uncovers the problem to me without me even looking for it, if that makes sense. But if that still doesn't uncover it, then I'll go and refactor the application code and make that as easy to understand as possible. Not necessarily because I think there's a problem there, but in the spirit of it's easier to troubleshoot easy to understand things than hard to understand things, the whole context is involved. So I'm going to try to take anything that touches it and clean that up. And again, I follow the same process so that it's at the least risk possible. And then if that still doesn't do it, I'll go to the test environment and I'll try to make the test environment as easy to understand as possible. Because that's a factor too. What do your seeds look like? What does your tooling look like? All that stuff. Sometimes those things introduce obstacles to understanding. And this is, this is getting lower and lower on my list. This is a bigger intervention, higher risk, more work, stuff like that. But if I get here, then I'll try to make that stuff easier to understand because it all helps.
Yeah, no, I like that suggestion too. And I think very analogous to a lot of application code debugging. Sometimes you go through and you start deleting things until, you see if anything that you deleted makes a difference, but you just try to pare it down to, the smallest scope you can for what can actually be affecting the code.
Yeah. And again, or not again, because we haven't said this yet, but this stuff doesn't have to be on the master branch. You don't have to merge these changes in. You can make sweeping, drastic changes on your own branch, and that's fine because it's just a separate branch.
Totally. Also, environment variables. I've seen people kind of introduce some logic branches. You want to be careful with that because you don't want to do anything that could. I guess environment variables are another source of non-determinism. It's like an external, yeah. I guess it's leaky state, it's external state. It's this external thing that affects the way that code is running. But sometimes if you need to, maybe you want to add some additional debugging code, you don't really want to check that in, but maybe it's helpful to know if other people see it on their branches or their machines. So, it's a good way to add some additional code to give you visibility into what's happening, but then selectively enable it just in cases where you need to.
Yeah, I think that's good. So Dan, we're about an hour in and we're only a fraction of the way into this blog post. So it's reproduction, diagnosis, application of the fix, and then some other stuff too. We're only partway through diagnosis. So we're not going to get nearly through this whole blog post. So I'm not even going to go any further with that. Maybe you'll be up for joining me and we can talk more on a future occasion. But I want to take a chance now. And first of all, if you have any more comments on fixing flaky tests and stuff like that, I guess I'll also comment that fixing flaky tests is really hard. And it's probably reflected in the fact that we've talked for an hour about these strategies and tactics just for reproducing and diagnosing flaky tests. We haven't even talked yet about fixing flaky tests or like how you should go about deciding whether to delete a flaky test. There's just so much stuff to it. So I think people should go into this problem with like a recognition of just how hairy these issues are. Because if you go into it expecting it to be easy, you'll get frustrated really quick. So I just want to say that like, this is not a simple, easy thing. There's a lot to it.
Yeah, and I'm glad you called that out because I've talked to a lot of engineers that I know are frustrated with this problem, you know, on their engineering team. And, you know, I think sometimes they kind of have the mentality of, you know, we should just fix all of them. But, you know, all the advice you just gave comes from the experience of actually working with these problems. And I think it's illustrative of how difficult they could be to solve. So while certainly, yes, you know, there's always some of that low-hanging fruit and, you know, tests are easy to fix. And I think it's good for engineering teams to have good, like, test and build hygiene and try to address those periodically. You know, sometimes it can be unrealistic and you're just never going to hit one of these. And sometimes they are, you know, really difficult to try to resolve.
Yeah. And I do want to make, I'll make a comment about deleting flaky tests because we've mentioned it. I don't want to leave people hanging about that. Okay, what are the pros and cons of deleting a flaky test? The cons are that it's a feedback loop. And if you get in the habit of fixing flaky tests, it's a positive feedback loop where the more flaky tests you fix, the more flaky tests you can fix faster. And you'll gain skills and gain confidence, and it just improves morale and stuff like that. And again, the more you fix, the more you will fix because you're getting stronger. And so if you delete flaky tests, you deprive yourself of that because the feedback loop goes in the other direction and you're not building your skills at all. And your policy becomes, oh, when there's a flaky test that seems too hard, we just delete it because we don't know how to fix it. That doesn't boost morale, obviously. That doesn't build your skills. That just, it leaves all those benefits on the table. Having said that, I do delete flaky tests more than never because sometimes coincidentally, and I emphasize the word coincidentally, a flaky test is also a test that happens to have no value. So just because a test exists doesn't automatically mean it's valuable. Sometimes people write pointless tests that don't actually test anything. Like, for example, testing for the presence of a Rails association that has no value. And so when I come across a test that is both zero value and flaky, I delete it. But otherwise, I really try to fix it. And it might seem like it's not worth it. Like I spend more time than would seem justified. But the point is not how much time you spend on any individual flaky test. The point is the benefit on average. So don't think about this individual test. Think about what you're going to accomplish in like a year. And is that effort over a year going to be worth it? That's the thing to think about rather than this individual test.
I really love that mindset. And I think in addition to, you know, just skills and familiarity and like the discipline of fixing them, you know, sometimes there are kind of more systematic things inside the code base that are causing that flakiness that you can actually, you know, reevaluate maybe how you're using some third-party library or how you're handling time in your application and not just fix one flaky test, but, you know, fix a lot of them and prevent future flakiness from occurring altogether. So, you know, certainly in those cases, you know, I encourage people to try to figure out, like, is there a linter rule you can put in place, or, you know, some way to just change your strategy for testing overall that, you know, could prevent this from ever popping up again in the future.
Yeah, it's always so satisfying when you change one thing and it fixes a bunch of flaky tests.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree. I delete them more than ever. I think, you know, maybe even not only in the case of no value, but, you know, sometimes value is, you know, circumstantial or contextual. Like it's, you know, if it's a part of code base you're not actively working on, if it's, you know, you are pretty confident that you have other tests maybe that provide the same coverage, which I guess is kind of what you're saying around, you know, there's not much value of that one test in itself. You know, I just think deleting, you know, can certainly be a good option, or marking it pending for a while. Another thing I've seen engineering teams do is skip that test from running.
Dangerous.
I've seen teams require, dangerous, but I've seen teams require like putting a date there, and they say like, you know, hey, I'm going to try to come back to this, but if this is still here as of this date, like, let's just delete it. Effectively skipping it is the same as deleting. But sometimes exactly. it at least unblocks the rest of the engineers. So while one engineer is investigating that cause of flakiness, you know, the other 10, 50, 100, 1,000 engineers on your team aren't bumping up against it as you're investigating it. Can be risky, need to be disciplined about it, but another option to consider.
Yeah, I would skip a test in one scenario only, which is if I'm going to skip it and then immediately actively work on it, because otherwise, candidly, it's a delusion. It's the idea that, oh, we'll fix it later when we have more time. But obviously later there's not more time. Usually later there's even less time. And so either decide to fix it right now or just don't fix it. But I mean, do fix it. Just decide to fix it right now. Right. Don't, yeah. Because yeah. You're not going to have more time later.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. I do think some of it is a function of how big your engineering team is. So, mm-hmm. You know, we talked about like date-based tests. And if you walk in on January 1st and you have 15 failing tests out of 25,000 and nobody on the team can get a build through until those 15 tests are fixed, you know, you probably don't want to block 99 right. engineers while that other one is, you know, maybe going through and trying to make those fixes. So some of it is also contextual, I think, based on the size of the project and the engineering team and how long the fix is going to take.
Yeah, definitely. So before we go, Dan, I want to give you a chance to say anything more you want to say about RWX, Captain, any of these other tools, that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah, thanks. I really appreciate that. You know, I mentioned them a couple times in this conversation because we are focused on building tools that help engineering teams solve build and test problems. I talked a little bit about ABQ, which is the best tool for splitting test suites into multiple jobs to run in parallel on CI. But Captain especially is focused on flaky tests. It helps engineering teams detect and mitigate flaky tests through retries and analyzing test results output to detect flakiness. It can actually also split test files for parallel execution and produce better test output for engineers to get better feedback on which tests failed. So we designed Captain largely to solve the types of problems that you're talking about here. It's an open source CLI that you can use totally for free. As I mentioned, there's a cloud component that kind of enhances some of the functionality and provides some of those like ongoing analytics. But otherwise, it's a CLI you can use to run your test suite, works with 15 different testing frameworks, and helps engineering teams detect and mitigate flaky tests.
Awesome. We'll definitely put that stuff in the show notes. Anything else you want to link people to or anything like that?
No, I think that was it. Like you mentioned, this is a deep topic, and
sure definitely,
you know, there's a lot more we could say about this, but you know, I think this is great for the first show on it, and really appreciate all the effort, Jason, you put into, you know, the community and your thoughtfulness around this, the guides that you're publishing, and you know, you're just putting out a lot of great content to help, you know, engineers solve these types of problems.
Thanks. I really appreciate that. Dear listener, I hope you got something out of this episode, and maybe you're going to listen to this and go attack some of your flaky tests. And if you do that, let me know how it goes. I would really love to hear about it. And Dan, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yep. Thank you, Jason.